Троих участниц панк-группы Pussy Riot арестовали.
Pussy Riot разделила российское общество и вызвала широкий резонанс.
В Москве зарегистрирован первый иностранный агент.
Есть иностранные агенты, они...
Ильдар Дадин вышел на свободу из колонии Алтайского края.
5 years ago this month, 3 women were arrested in Moscow, kicking off a crackdown on dissent that continues to this day. This week, one political prisoner walked free from a Siberian prison camp after alleging systemic torture and sparking a national scandal. From Pussy Riot to Ildar Dadin. For the past half decade, the Kremlin has waged a far-ranging war on dissent, cracking down on NGOs, strictly policing the internet, prosecuting people for comments on social media, expanding the legal definition of extremism, and outlawing things like blasphemy. It's been dizzying, and it appears to have been effective. But was it? What is the state of dissent in Vladimir Putin's Russia 5 years after Pussy Riot? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hi, Dan.
And joining us on the Skype line from Moscow is journalist Mark Bennett, author of the book I'm Going to Ruin Their Lives, Inside Putin's War on the Russian Opposition. Welcome to back to the podcast, Mark. Great to have you back on.
Hi.
So this is going to be a little confusing with two Marks on the program, even though you spell your names differently, but I guess we'll manage. So let's get the ball rolling with you, Mark Bennett. Your book on Putin's war on the opposition, which was in effect a war on dissent in general, was published a year ago. And where do you see us in this war at this point? Has the Kremlin won? What is the state of dissent in Russia today in these conditions?
Well, obviously it's not exactly North Korea yet. So I think the Kremlin will always find it very hard to eradicate completely dissent in Russia. But there's no doubt that people are afraid. I mean, of acquaintances and friends I have, I know a lot of people who loathe Putin, who are really hate the way that state media has been turned into a kind of propaganda machine, and hate what the Kremlin is doing in Ukraine and Syria, but they're extremely wary, afraid of taking to the streets, because the Kremlin has made it quite clear that if you do step out of line, then you risk the chance of being put into prison. Once you go to prison, anything can happen to you, as we've seen with Dadin, tortured, just disappear into the black hole. And I think it takes. And this even not even taking to the streets, but posting. I know a lot of people who are also afraid of just even liking critical things on social media, you know, because I mean, people have been arrested for extremism just for sharing posts.
And with good reason. Yeah, CODA had an interesting series they put out just this week. Jailed for a Like, where they're doing each individual case. But I would imagine that it's become pretty chilling, but yet dissent still exists, no? I mean, it's still there.
Yeah, obviously. I mean, as we saw with Navalny's investigation into Medvedev's vast wealth yesterday, obviously there are still people fighting the Kremlin. But I think people like Navalny, he's kind of protected in a way by his status as a very well-known critic, and also by his the sympathetic coverage he gets in the West. Whereas if you're an ordinary person, it's kind of notable that no one really cared about Dadin in the West until the torture allegations surfaced. I mean, he was arrested, put in the jail. I mean, a few obvious sites that focus on Russia covered it, and maybe got a few mentions elsewhere, but there wasn't any great outcry or anything. It was just seen as just collateral damage, I guess, until the horrific torture allegations came. I don't know. I think there's definitely been... Kremlin has definitely become far less tolerant of dissent. It's kind of notable that the march in memory of Nemtsov, which took place on Sunday, was the first opposition march that had been allowed to take place in the center for a year. Mm-hmm. And even things that wouldn't really think pose a particular threat to the Kremlin as such. I mean, demonstration against the law, decriminalizing domestic violence. They weren't even allowed to gather in the center. They had to go to Sokolniki Park in in the east of Moscow, basically rallying a forest of ones of protests against the war in Syria, have just been refused permission. Against internet censorship, they're also made basically to stand in a small wood with their signs and telling the hedgehogs how much they're against internet censorship. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I think while obviously the Kremlin likes to have a certain amount of dissent in the media, like Nova Gazeta, Dosht, even if they don't like them to flourish, they allow them to exist, because then they can say, well, we have free media, with dissenting voices are allowed. I think they've become particularly sensitive to people gathering on the streets in central Moscow, even to a ridiculous extent. I mean, Mikhadin and his friends, for all their bravery, right now they're not any threat at all to the Kremlin. Only four or five people are standing in Red Square with a sign saying Putin is a thief is hardly going to bring down regime.
Let's switch to the other Mark. Mark Galeotti, your thoughts. Has the Kremlin managed to neutralize dissent? Can dissidents or NGOs still have an impact in this environment?
Well, I think it's probably worth disaggregating. I mean, you know, I think there's three separate intertwined phenomena. There's the dissident, such as Ildar Dadin, which is essentially an expression of conscience as much as anything else. And these people precisely tend to be small numbers or individuals. They can be symbolically powerful, but they're also characteristically, the state has no trouble sweeping them up, assuming that the state is powerful. Then you have the NGO sector, civil society, which is, instead of just simply, I mean, you know, dissent is primarily precisely about an expression of conscience. NGOs are much more about trying to make something happen, in other words, bring about some kind of political effect, often on a very, very small and local scale. And again, there, I think what we have seen is the state manage to push and push and push so that there are very, very local, small-scale activities. But even things like the Council of Soldiers' Mothers, which for a long time had sort of protected status because it's soldiers' mothers. I mean, right. What could be more sort of sanctified than that? But even that's now had to be sort of register itself as a foreign agent. And then there is the third level, which is actually outright political opposition of the sort we see with Navalny. And there, again, I think in some ways that necessarily operates at the moment only insofar as the Kremlin is willing to allow it. I mean, we see the current discussion over whether or not Navalny will actually be able to stand at all, depending on whether he can get the most recent court case overturned. But nonetheless, this is actually aimed at systemic change. So in some ways we have a spectrum from the sort of small scale, just the I do not want to be a part of this, to try and create some kind of least small scale local change to the whole systemic thing. And I think the thing is what we see is across that spectrum, yeah, I mean, the state at the moment is not in any threat, or not under any threat. It can do what it wants with them. So in some ways it's a question of, well, everything has a price tag. Everything has a political and sometimes economic price tag attached to it. What is it that they're willing to allow and see some kind of benefit, and what is it that they're happy to step on? And I think it's interesting in this respect that they are, on the one level at the moment, allowing Navalny to continue, and indeed, you know, his videos showing corruption and so forth, whereas actually concentrating their fire more on the sort of the grassroots scale. Because this is, I think, what they want to do is make sure that there is no connection between society and political radicalism or political desire for change. That everyone thinks, even if they actually think, gosh, yes, that Navalny, he's got the right idea, we need to change the system, we need to bring down Putin, whatever, that everyone is frankly just too scared to do anything about it or say anything about it. An atomized society is a controllable society.
So it's almost a paradoxical situation in which the leaders, the high-profile people, the Navalnys, have a sense of, as Mark Bennett's put it, immunity. And where your average, and let's face it, Dadin was, he was a fixture at protests, but he was hardly a household name. These people are at risk, or somebody who happens to like the wrong thing on Facebook is at risk.
Exactly. It comes back to this point of basically, on the one hand, it gives the state, as other Mark said, the capacity to say, you see, we allow dissent, we allow opposing views. But on the other hand, you shatter any chance, you hope, if you're the state, of those people being able to connect and build some kind of a grassroots movement. Because that's what it really, what is the crucial thing. And that's something that's up to now, all the various attempts at change haven't really managed to do, especially outside Moscow, is build that connection with some kind of mass movement.
And it's interesting that the place where the Kremlin is the most aggressive is the middle part of your little pyramid here, the NGO sector and civil society, where they seem to have zero tolerance.
Well, no, I mean, that exists, but again, on a very, very scattered local scale. You know, if you are a group of concerned parents somewhere in some provincial town who just simply is trying to campaign because not enough money is being spent on your school, actually, you know, unless the mayor is particularly opposed, there is scope for that to happen. If anything, I think the real attention is being focused on the individual level.
Uh-huh.
Because I think precisely that's it. If you have atomized society, then basically doesn't really matter what else is going on.
Uh-huh. I wanted to shift a bit to Ildar Dadin, because this is what was in the news this week, and this is the fact that his release almost exactly coincided with the five-year anniversary of the arrest of members of Pussy Riot gave me the idea for this topic. Dadin was released in prison this week, of course, after alleging systemic torture. Not only did he was he a fixture at protest actions, he's been at LGBT rights protests, he's been at protests in support of Navalny, Savchenko, against the war in Ukraine, what have you, but he was also known for staging these one-man protests, you know, holding signs like Putin's an enemy of the people, and according to the law, the letter of the law, which doesn't really matter, but the letter of the law says you don't have to ask for permission to do this. But yet he was arrested in prison based on a controversial and draconian law, the infamous Article 212.1 of the Russian Criminal Code, which provides up to 5 years in prison for those that violate rules on protests more than three times in 180 days. Dadin to this date is the only person prosecuted under this law. In a recent column for Republic Ru, opposition journalist Oleg Kashin wrote the following about Dadin and the significance of his case, and I want to read this out. Dadin's dissent is primarily a rejection of the system of relations with the state in which citizens are objects and have no political rights. Dadin defended his right to participate in his protests, and he defended his right not to be beaten in prison. And the key word here is his, because although Dadin was a recognizable face at protests for many years, he never claimed political leadership or a political role. He did not run for the Duma. He did not sit at roundtables with Mikhail Kasyanov. He did not apply for permission to hold marches along the boulevards. Mark Bennett, you're in Moscow and in a better position than us to judge this. How much did the Dadin case resonate? Is Kashin overstating his importance here? How significant is Dadin? Are we looking at the new post-Soviet man here, or is this just an isolated case?
I think the Kremlin won two ways with the Dadin case. I think firstly it won because by the amount of media attention the case got, it illustrated very well, again, that if you do stand up to the Kremlin, you do take to the streets, you do ignore the authorities, then you will be put in prison and you will be hung from your arms and threatened with rape, is what happened to Dadin. So I think people got the message. Secondly, they released the Supreme Court, overturned basically his conviction, thereby proving, quotation mark, close quotation mark, that Russia has, as the old Soviet saying went, the most humane courts in the world. So I think, in a way, they showed that dissent will be punished brutally, but we also have a fair legal system, and if someone has been jailed unfairly, then we'll let you go. Obviously, that's the message they were trying to send across, I think. As for Dadin himself, I think right now he'll have a very strong moral case to build some kind of movement, party as such. Because his standing within the opposition has obviously rocketed. Then again, the group of protesters that he's involved in, even amongst them, they're very split. And I think it's without seeming to unnecessarily criticize people, some of the protesters that Dadin associates with are themselves fairly bizarre individuals who, for example, one illustration, one of Dadin's comrades as such, when he was arrested and when he was being tortured and the torture allegations surfaced, I wrote an article for Politico, and there was a picture of Politico illustrated the article with a photograph of Dadim at a protest that it said he organized. I got this furious letter from another street protester who said, Dadim had nothing to do with organizing that protest. That protest was organized by me, my other friend. Please write to the editors of Dadim now. It's just very petty.
I mean, this is the oldest story in the Russian opposition. They spend more time fighting each other than they do fighting the authorities.
Yeah, but I mean, obviously that's just a minor point, but from speaking to some of these people, they do have some very kind of strange views about, for example, one of them wrote a long letter on Facebook about how much he loved Fidel Castro. Another one congratulated the American people with the election of Trump. So, I don't know.
But what about dotting the symbol? I mean, you make an interesting counterintuitive point that the Kremlin, that this is a win for the Kremlin because what happened, the horrific things that happened to him will serve to scare people. The fact that they got out even benefits the Kremlin, and that now they can pretend they're humane. But what about the symbol of this man who, by all accounts, seems to be a very sympathetic figure, walking away from this and seeming to win by getting his conviction overturned? You don't think that symbol has power?
He's obviously a symbol for the opposition, but I don't think we should overestimate his importance for the vast majority of the Russian population, most of whom maybe would have seen something on television, perhaps, but I would say 85% of Russians wouldn't be able to name him, wouldn't be able to give you any details about the case.
Mark, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think, unfortunately, Dadim has become a symbol of they'll let you walk away after they've kicked the snot out of you, which is not necessarily the kind of inspirational message that is going to get people flocking to his cause. I mean, again, when it comes down to it, I mean, as Mark said, firstly, you know, who else knows about this? The people who know about Dadim, the people who care, are the people who are already opposed to the Kremlin. It's not actually as if there's any evidence at the moment that it's sort of got wider resonance. Secondly, look, I mean, on one level, to be the kind of dissident that Dadim is extraordinarily difficult. I cannot comprehend the kind of personal bravery that makes you willing to put yourself in those circumstances. Absolutely, I could not. I'd be a hapless coward. But on the other hand, it's also, on one level, perversely easy, in that essentially it's about you, your body, your conscience, your future. Actually organizing, inspiring others, creating some, and actually moving it in a direction which needs change, that is a very, very different, and in some ways more difficult challenge. I mean, in some ways, I mean, of course, Dadim stood for something, but in many ways what he stood was simply, I'm not willing to let this pass without protesting about it, not in my name, in effect. Now, that is different from actually saying, here is a programmatic approach to how things can be different. I mean, I think the problem is that, however powerful as symbols are highly malleable and, in a way, often multiple. That precisely, for some people, Dadim is going to be a symbol of bravery and sort of human resistance to an inhuman system. But for many others, it's a case of, this is a person who, you know, walked into the cogwheels. They chewed him up and then spat him out because they didn't care. Mm. They weren't afraid.
So you would agree with Mark Bennett that this is a net win for the Kremlin?
Unfortunately, I mean, however much they sometimes take public relations, I mean, even if we go back to Pussy Riot, which in many ways was certainly internationally a much, much bigger story. I mean, firstly, it wasn't actually that the regime went after him. It was the Orthodox Church that right. really said we need to crack them down. I mean, if the regime had been smart, it would have just simply have fined them, patronised them and thrown them out and just said, oh, just a bunch of silly girls doing something that's offensive. But even actually after it became a cause célèbre, yes, of course, it led to protests in the West and certain perspectives about what kind of a regime Russia was becoming. But at the same time, they were also able to spin it to different constituencies as, we believe in upholding certain values, we believe in upholding the church's dignity and so forth. So in a way, no one represents just one symbol. They actually can be spun symbolically different ways to different constituencies.
So in as much as the Pussy Riot case was the beginning of the crackdown and dissent, it was also the beginning of the use of the traditional values stick to beat your opponents with.
I mean, that almost implies that it was some kind of pivotal moment that started other things. I'm not convinced. I mean, I think actually...
I think we saw a proliferation of this.
I think it's more that the protests created a certain climate... at which point Pussy Riot happened to come along. I mean, in a way, if you're going to say it happened to be the start, that's one thing. But, I mean, I certainly don't think that so after Pussy Riot, they thought, right, this is what we're going to be doing now.
No, but I do think they saw an opportunity at the time to use this to push an agenda that, let's face it, the agenda to push the traditional values things predates Pussy Riot. It goes back, I trace it back to 2012, actually, with a strategy paper that came out of the Kremlin to use this internationally as well as domestically. But the Pussy Riot case gave them the perfect opportunity to do so. But if you go back 5 years and you look at where Russia was 5 years ago, when it looked like civil society was reawakening, when it looked like civil society was finding its voice, when it looked like change was coming, and if you go back and listen to podcasts 5 years ago and things that you and I were saying into these microphones 5 years ago, we saw a very different future seeming to shape up. We were not the only ones that were wrong about this, unfortunately. But if you look at where it is today, you'd almost think they basically wrote the textbook here on how to suppress dissent. No?
I mean, I think what they understood rightly is that actually the most dangerous thing for a regime is hope. When you actually think that you might be able to accomplish something, it's much more tempting to do something. And for in a variety of ways, they have acted to try and squeeze out that sense of hope. And, I mean, unfortunately, at the same time, the anti-Kremlin movement also did a pretty good job by precisely the way that it time and time again failed to cohere, failed to agree, and missed in some ways what was an historic opportunity around that time to actually sort of move beyond certain constituencies and certain things. But yes, but above all, I think that, you know, the Kremlin has understood that in some ways, the thing is, I mean, one can go back to Lenin. One should always go back to Lenin, this year.
Everything goes back to Lenin.
But in this year, I mean, you know, Lenin said that one of the preconditions for revolution is a critical absence of will on the part of the regime. You know, revolutionaries very rarely bring down regimes. In a way, revolutionaries just give that final push to a regime that's already tottering. And in this case, I mean, unfortunately, the Putin regime has demonstrated of late no lack of resolution, no lack of will.
Mm. It's almost like they found their will at that moment. Mark Bennett, you did write the book on Putin writing the book on this. What lessons have you seen? I mean, that book was published, like I said, a year ago, and it mostly focused on the Bolotnaya case. But what lessons do you draw from what they were able to accomplish here? Would you agree with Mark Galeotti that it's the taking away the hope, or is this more a question of fear?
Well, I'd say it's a mixture of the two, really. I mean, like I said at the beginning, I think that I don't think the stakes are big enough for the majority of Russians to take to the streets right now. I mean, especially in Moscow, where despite the economic slump, despite all the problems, people are still living a far lot better than they did in the 1990s. So right now, it's... are you willing to take to the streets for, as Navalny said, a matter of respect and self-worth? Because Muscovites aren't starving. Yeah, lots of them actually support Putin. That's another issue. But I mean, even his opponents, they're doing okay. Yeah? I mean, a lot of them have got families, a lot of them have got mortgages and things, you know. So it's the point hasn't come yet where you can be as disgusted as you want by the regime. You can be disgusted as you want by state media. But to take to the streets knowing that you could be locked up for 5 years and tortured right now, for a lot of people, that's a very large step to take, and a very important step to take, which a lot of people just simply aren't ready to do. And I've spoken to a lot of people about it who said after Bolotnaya they realized that they could just be locked up for a long time and that they would be forgotten, basically, you know, by most Russians and a lot of people in the international society. So and I also think, obviously, follows on from that the opposition isn't and wasn't really devoted enough to its cause. Just comes back to the old debate about whether they should have ignored the Kremlin's demands that they move their protests from the very center of Moscow, from Revolution Square on December 10th, 2011, to Bolotnaya, which they did, which was basically the end of any revolution that could have happened, because you don't allow the people you're trying to topple to tell you where you can go to gather, call for them to be toppled. It doesn't happen. I mean, for example, in Ukraine, Maidan, the authorities said you can't have any more protests. The next day, 1.5 million people turned out. In Moscow, they said you can't have a protest there, but you can go over there if you want to shout for a bit, then go home. And they said, okay, that pretty much set the tone for it.
Mark Galeotti, I know you wanted to jump in.
Well, again, I mean, I agree. And I think in part the whole thing is the very arbitrariness of this process, which is in some ways it is a strength. You know, there are still people liking things on Facebook and not being picked up by the FSB. There are still marches and other protest acts from time to time in which people don't get grabbed and dragged off to prison or whatever. But it could happen. And in some ways, I mean, I think, you know, this is in this respect a very Andropovian minimum effort, maximum impact sort of strategy, is because people are aware that it does happen sometimes. Mm-hmm. That actually, you know, is a tremendously powerful deterrent, because if you happen to throw the dice and they all come up ones, if you're unlucky, then the impact is catastrophic. It's not just simply, oh, we'll be picked up and I'll spend an unpleasant night in a cell and then be fined. It's actually terribly disastrous thing could happen to you. So because the potential is so bad, even though actually very few people really are targeted, the fear factor is that much greater.
Mm-hmm. And this, again, as Mark Bennett pointed out earlier, is that where the Dadin thing comes in and does play into the Kremlin hands, because how widely publicized the horrific torture he endured, how many people heard about that? I mean, we wouldn't have heard about that at all otherwise. I wanted to move to another related topic. This week, also in the news, police searched the apartment of activist Zoya Svetova, who has ties to Kremlin foe Mikhail Khodorkovsky's Open Russia organization. Mark, I know you've been thinking about this a lot. Mark Galeotti, how much influence can NGOs like Open Russia have at this point? I mean, Khodorkovsky is basically working from the outside here. His NGO is located outside of Russia. The Kremlin can't really touch him, but they can touch they can touch people like Svetova who are working for him inside of Russia. So
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, I mean, Khodorkovsky model is in some ways it's a hybrid. It's a hybrid war against the Kremlin. is precisely, on the one hand, it is an NGO, or it works through NGOs, but also to a large extent, it is, frankly, a political movement. Now, Khodorkovsky makes a big thing about saying, we are not about bringing down the current regime. We are about creating preconditions so that when this regime falls, we are ready. Now, that's a very nice line. However, it is disingenuous, and I don't really think of Khodorkovsky as a disingenuous sort of soul. I mean, clearly, anything that even just creates the notion that there can be a post-Putin Russia is already actually intrinsically subversive. Same, I mean, as soon as you're trying to push forward certain values. I mean, this is, as much as anything else, a normative struggle. It's a struggle over values as anything else. So actually, in some ways, I would say we have two different things. One is what's happening on the NGO level. And the other one is, in some ways, two different political models, which is Navalny versus Khodorkovsky. Khodorkovsky is in some ways trying to do it by stealth in the long term. Navalny is actually doing it overtly in the short term.
And those two things aren't necessarily mutually exclusive.
No, not at all.
I mean, Khodorkovsky, you're right, Mark. I see Khodorkovsky as playing a long, patient game here. Actually, I do take him at his word when he says that this is not about overthrowing the regime now, because I've always thought that Khodorkovsky is playing a long game. He's focusing on grassroots organizing, consciousness raising, education, things like that. Like you said, to create the preconditions for a good civil society if this regime should fall. But I don't think he's expecting the regime to fall anytime soon. I expect he's aiming to be ready when it does. And one has to wonder if this strategy can pay off. Mark Bennett, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't really see what other choice he has but to play a long-term strategy, because in the short term, I mean, most Russians loathe him, quite rightly so, as a willing part of the system which fleeced the country of billions of dollars in the 1990s. And the rest of them are just spectacularly indifferent to him. He's also extremely out of touch with Russia as well. I mean, remember, he hasn't actually lived in Russia, apart from a prison cell, for the last 15 years. So he has very little recent first-hand experience of life here. And again, I also think he's a very convenient figure for the Kremlin. He's associated with the poverty of the 1990s. I mean, I don't know if you want me to go into a rant about how much I dislike Khodorkovsky. just because he was persecuted by Putin doesn't make him a good person.
But forget Khodorkovsky the man for a moment and think about the strategy and about the work that, and think, I mean, more of Open Russia as an organization and the work that it's doing.
Yeah.
This seems to be something that has more of a chance of success than some of the other things we're seeing, I would guess, or Mark.
Well, I feel, for the record, let me also say that I fully understand what other Mark was saying about Khodorkovsky, and precisely, I think, you know, one has to go quite a long way to find a Russian who has anything positive to say about Khodorkovsky. But I think in some ways, my concern is that Khodorkovsky's long-term sort of model actually falls between two different approaches. It's not actually about reaching out at the moment and creating some kind of anti-government movement, subversive operation, Khodorkovsky could do, firstly from the fact that he's safely outside of Russia, and secondly because he still has a lot of money to play with. It's not actually going out there and really challenging the Kremlin. It's nibbling away at the margins. But on the other hand, nor is it really, I would say, rooting itself so solidly that if actually the Kremlin decided tomorrow that it really was a problem, that they could not just simply roll it up. I mean, I think, you know, again, it might be laudable, the desire to try and do with everything, you know, openly, on the level and transparently or whatever. But that is also precisely the secret policeman's dream. I think my concern is how far this is actually something that really can have traction in Russia, and how far this is something that makes Khodorkovsky feel better and makes him feel that he is doing something in Russia, that when all these people who take his money and attend the seminars that are created and so forth, when they all get rounded up and taken to sort of PM Camp 47 or whatever, that, you know, he can say, well, I did my best, but unfortunately this regime is too horrible. I can't quite see what it is. I mean, yes, the long view or whatever, but there's very little evidence of what he's doing actually has much wider impact, except amongst the very people who are already kind of committed. It's a way of providing some support to people who don't like the Kremlin. Sure, and that's great, and I don't want to devalue that. But the real struggle is outside those circles. And Navalny, you know, whatever else might say about him, is actually getting more name recognition out there. There was the interesting Levada poll.
Well, that poll and the way everybody spun that poll told me more about the people that were spinning it than about the poll itself.
But the bottom line is more people have heard of him now.
More people have heard of him, and a smaller percentage of that larger percentage is willing to vote for him. But in fact, more people would vote for him now than would have voted for him.
Precisely. But the main thing, even if they're not going to vote for him, he now has some degree of purchase on their imagination. The only kind of purchase Khodorkovsky has on people's imagination is precisely different ways in which they would want to abuse him for how they impoverished Russia in the 1990s. So, I mean, I think this is the issue. It's actually that Khodorkovsky is not, I mean, unless there's some dramatic breakthrough, at the moment he hasn't, for me, articulated a way of reaching out to the other Russians who at the moment hate him and at the moment don't listen to the people he's funding.
Mm. Mark Bennis, what do you think about the... Is the Navalny model the more effective of these two models, then? Would you...
Definitely, I think. I think Navalny operates on a very base level, which appeals to a lot of people. I mean, what's he targeting? He's targeting rich... Basically, if he boils down to it, he's targeting rich, corrupt people and migrants, basically. which has a lot more potential to attract millions of Russians to his cause than Khodorkovsky, who's funding Open Russia, which is basically, as Mark said, preaching to the converted. And I mean, I know just from personal experience that when people get their hands on Navalny's reports, even on Yashin's reports, that people who do ostensibly support Putin, when they actually look at them and read them, talking about people here, I know who involved with the security forces, for example, they're like, wow, where can I read more of this? You know, so I mean, the message is there. The message is very dangerous for the Kremlin. And also, again, as because he is such a populist, you know, I mean, I think some of the Western coverage of him is very strange, because I mean, if he was in France or England, he would be probably written about in exactly the same way as we read about Le Pen, for example. You know? He said horrible, not racist things about people from Central Asia. That's another issue, of course. But
although he's toned that down,
years. he's toned that down because he was told to turn it down. He was told to turn it down. I know he was told to turn it down by his liberal backers. And one of his quite high profile liberal backers told me, kind of, and asked me not to quote him, that lots of his nasty statements about people from Central Asia just made because he's just kind of ignorant and uneducated, but they're trying to work with him. And again, I mean, he is very brave, and you have to admire his bravery for going after the Kremlin and pointing out massive corruption. And for that alone, I would respect him. But getting back to the point, I think Navalny's message is a very potent one, and it's a very easy one to digest as well. You know, I mean, there's nothing intellectual about it. It's like, as he himself says, you know, don't lie, don't steal, you know, which is most people. I mean, it would be very hard to find someone who wouldn't agree with that. You know, I mean, his slogans are very, very, very easy to handle and very easy to agree with. So I think that, the Kremlin would be terrified of him if he ever got a real national platform on which to, I mean, for example, debate Putin on live television. So.
But yet they don't fully neutralize him. They don't.
That's the point.
What do you attribute that to? Why don't they put him away if he is such a threat?
I was thinking about that recently. I mean, the immediate answer you get is because they're afraid of making him a martyr. But I mean, Nemtsov became a martyr. There was obviously they did attempt to put him away, and tens of thousands of people rallied outside Parliament in the biggest unsanctioned protest in modern Russia, I think. So I'd imagine that scared them off a little bit, because unsanctioned protests with tens of thousands of people who were like mainly in their 20s. And 30s, that's a very unpredictable thing right outside.
Yeah, they were climbing up the walls of the Duma, if I remember correctly.
So, I mean, I think they took a step back from there, really. And now, I mean, it seems they always try to test public opinion as well. All these like court cases he keeps going through, you know, and he gets suspended sentence or whatever. And they, in the run up, they're obviously checking what people are writing, what people are thinking. You know, are people ready to go again and rally for him? I think they'd love to put him away. They prefer him just to disappear, basically. But I don't buy that he's like a Kremlin project, because I think again his message is too dangerous to be a Kremlin project.
I think it comes down to this business of the price tag. Of course, if they wanted to kill him, if they wanted to lock him up, they could. There's no question about that. It's just that what would the implications of that be? And one of them is precisely, I think, that would be the last gasp of any kind of open anti-Kremlin opposition. The next step, you know, if basically people feel, well, it's absolutely impossible, 99% of people would therefore give up, and 1% of people would go actually into, you know, in effect, subversion, potentially even armed subversion or something like that. Again, this is, after all, the 100th anniversary of 1917. Not because I suddenly think there will be a Bolshevik revolution or anything similar, but the point is, it would precisely drive people into a sort of particular direction. I think at the moment they feel Navalny is potentially problematic, but not a serious threat. And if they are, I mean, as by all accounts, you know, they want a record turnout and mandate for 2018 for Putin's election then. And one of the ways of generating interest is to create a faux... challenge. I mean, I don't think anyone's going to say, wow, it's going to be the Zyuganov versus Putin needle match. That is not going to get people out on the streets.
But letting Navalny in is risky. It is risky. It gives him a truly national platform. So it's we'll see. I'm not sure if we'll be 5 years down the road. We'll be looking at 10 years of Putin's war on the opposition and war on dissent, or if we'll be looking at something else, but we'll see. It's a good time to shift gears. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and shift gears slightly to examine something that's been strangely absent from Russian politics of late. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us on the Skype line from Moscow is journalist Mark Bennett, author of the book I'm Going to Ruin Their Lives, Inside Putin's War on the Opposition. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Внутренней политики очень важно.
К внутренней политике.
Во внутренней политике мы.
А внутренняя политика.
Это все больше о политике внутренней.
There's been something conspicuously absent from Russian domestic politics of late. Politics. Or at least visible politics. Presidential elections are a year away, and in past cycles, that was the time when the court politics, the clan warfare, and the intrigue went into high gear. Khodorkovsky's arrest and the subsequent struggle over Rosneft and Gazprom for UK's assets preceded Putin's re-election campaign in 2004. In the 2008 election was preceded by the 2008 Siloviki Wars, and the elite jockeying and backstabbing went into overdrive prior to the castling in 2011 and the election in 2012. But aside from scintillating questions about whether Alexei Navalny will be allowed to run and speculation about whether Gennady Zyuganov will step aside as communist leader and make way for a new generation, it's been pretty barren out there. Mark Galliotti, we talked a bit about this off mic already. What's happening here? Has court politics disappeared entirely, or has it just gone deep underground and nobody can see it?
I think it's three things. One is, to an extent, yes, nowadays things have gone deep underground or deep within those kind of inner circles. But secondly, and I think this is a reflection of it, actually, this is not the same Putinism as before. The old Putinism was much, much more about competitive authoritarianism, about precisely these rival power blocks, which are encouraged, frankly, up to a certain point until it became dysfunctional, to compete. And yes, inevitably that means that in certain times of flux and uncertainty, that would often come to the surface. Now we actually have a much, much more sort of late, increasingly ossified sort of imperial system, whereby instead you have a relative handful of close cronies and trusted agents who actually are in charge. So, I mean, I think there just isn't quite the same. I mean, you know, we saw a little bit like with over the Ulyukayev arrests, but I think there isn't the same scope for or tolerance of those kind of open things. But the third point I would make is there has been change, but I think, you know, the current remont, the current process of the reconstruction is very much aimed at addressing the architecture rather than the detail. We've seen Vino come in the presidential administration, and there is clearly sort of movements and reshuffles continuing within the presidential administration, some of which we get to see, some of which we don't. We've seen a certain amount of movement at the gubernatorial level.
Yeah.
You know, again, sort of generally sort of shuffling the pack there, elevating certain people. And we've still seen the sort of shakedown of how the Duma is managed under Volodin as the new speaker. So in some ways, I mean, these are dull elements, but these are basically the bones of the system, the skeletal structures and the sinews. So, you know, it may well be that in due course we will see the more fleshy politics emerging. Mm. But I think things are happening. But again, unfortunately, these are the things that fascinate wonks. It's not like us, but they don't actually lead to the fun, exciting clan war type stories.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree with you that this is a different kind of Putinism. It's kind of, it's made this turn from kind of, I guess you'd call transactional Putinism to ideological Putinism is one of the ways I've described it. But yet, you still have these power blocks. These bureaucratic interests and these clans still exist. And they're still fighting over scarcer and scarcer resources, in which case you might expect those fights to get
fiercer. The etiquette has changed. You know, so how you fight has I think, does sort of represent one of the areas that have changed. In the old days, exactly, things could spill over fairly openly, And that was a kind of almost an accepted part of the system. That was the boys will be boys model of Russian court politics. And then, yes, after a certain point, particularly if it began to look problematic, as with, for example, the Solovyov clan war,
right.
At that point, Putin steps in and says, okay, right, I'm settling this now. You know, you go to your room, you don't get any supper or whatever. This is not how modern Putinism works. The idea that you should have the autonomy.
Interesting modifier there. I would have said late Putinism, but
well, I mean, yeah, I mean, I'm hoping it's late Putinism, but you know, I mean, I think you know what happens now is you actually have the way that struggles are played out in the main. I mean, obviously the Ulyukayev case was actually a bit of a sort of a throwback, but you know, in the main, instead of it being sort of at the level of institution versus institution, I think it's you know it takes place. Different people whispering in Putin's ear and a different resolution being reached. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this is not something that should be played out in public.
Mm-hmm.
It almost is, I mean, kind of bizarrely, it's a little bit like what happened with organized crime. I have to return it to make it organized crime. But in terms of in the 1990s, there were all these sort of struggles. And when Putin came in, the word went out. Not, you can't do crime. Of course, that was going to happen. But more or less, nothing that actually makes it look as if you're challenging the authority of the state to control the streets. So what happened is the kind of the drive-by shootings and the car bombings were replaced just simply by targeted killings. And that was okay. Gangster can kill gangster, but if it, you know, but not in a way that makes it look as if the state can't protect people's safety. Well, in some ways, what's happened is likewise. It's not that the institutions and interests are not competing, but it's been made clear, no. You don't do it out in the open anymore because that makes the system look weak.
Mm.
That makes Putin look as if he's not in control. Instead, if you know your disagreements have to be prosecuted in a very different way,
mm. Which makes our jobs a lot harder. Mark Bennett, you're in Moscow. How does that look? How does it look from there?
Well, I don't know. I mean, firstly, as far as Kremlin intrigue goes, we've always basically received a second or even third hand, anyway, even fourth hand. You know, so for me, there's either. Two alternatives, basically. It's the elite is just gathered around Putin as the national leader, or he's running a tighter ship. Probably it's just a mixture of the two, basically. I mean, as you said, there was the recent leak, but that was obviously came with the Kremlin's blessing that Putin wants to use next year's elections as a kind of referendum on his 17 years in power. So, I mean, that was something, at least it was coming from the Kremlin, you know. But yeah, basically, I would agree that there just isn't the scope really anymore for that kind of intrigue that we saw in the past. I think definitely the atmosphere is right. The political atmosphere isn't right. I mean, lots of the hardline Russian political elite. I think Russia's in a state of war basically. In the West, you know, so we've kind of got a kind of war mentality going on. Any kind of open dissent against Putin, or just even any signs of infighting, is basically a betrayal. We all know how Putin reacts to betrayal, perceived or otherwise.
Mm. I mean, a couple of the things I have noticed, and Mark, you alluded to this, the Duma has become noticeably less clownish, if you will. I mean, you're not seeing the ridiculousness coming out of the Duma under Volodin that you saw coming out of the previous Duma. Would this be also, would you see this as a reflection, again, of the same dynamic you're describing among the Kremlin clans?
Well, I think it's two things. One is, it is just simply a sense that, in fact, the Duma precisely had become a caricature of itself, and that did not reflect well on the state. I mean, I think there was a sort of a... At some point, there was clearly a sense of, well, actually, this is how we neutralize democracy. By you know allowing or encouraging its representatives to basically sort of don clown's feet and so forth, but there's a realization that in fact that actually undermines the credibility of the system as a whole, and also I think it all you know it reflects Volodin's presence. You know, there is someone who actually you know is a much more powerful and effective manager of the process. But again, I think, you know, if we come into looking at how late Putinism, you know, works, it is about essentially a disciplined and effective state machine, precisely as Marx said, you know, for wartime. You know, that there isn't the same scope for messing around, for the open disputes and so forth. Now everyone has to realise that this is a crucial moment under the sort of glorious national leader, and everyone should get behind that. So I think, generally speaking, yes, there is far, far less scope for the kind of antics that we knew and loved in the old days.
Right. And yeah, we sure did love them, and I sure do miss them. The other thing I notice is that the action seems to be in the systemic opposition. I mean, most notably in the communists right now, because we're seeing this back and forth about whether Zhuganov is going to run or not. And my first reaction, this is like, who the hell cares, right? But then when you think about it a little more, the communists, as Mark, you've pointed out, are the one force outside of the Kremlin that could put a lot of people on the streets. It's almost like it's not a shadow state, but it is a mass movement. And if you did get rid of the geriatric leadership and had more dynamic young leaders who acted more like an opposition, that could change into something very different than what we've seen for the last 25 years, no?
Yeah, I mean, and anyway, in some ways one can almost wonder if this is the fallback if Navalny's deemed to be a little bit too risky and they actually do end up saying, oh, no, you can't stand or whatever. Maybe, I mean, let's be perfectly honest, all they need to do is find a communist with a pulse. and already that makes them look as if they're sort of a different type of force. Of course, they're not going to be a serious challenge to Putin.
Right.
But, for the spectacle of competition, they might feel the communists are there. So in some ways, it's almost like, I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, I have no idea whether the real discussion is taking place within the Communist Party as to whether or not Zhuganov will run, or whether it's taking place within the Kremlin, as to whether or not they want the sort of the safe option or something that's a little bit, I mean, I hesitate to use the word edgy, but, a little bit less safe.
Well, it could be edgy. If all it takes is a charismatic, young, telegenic, leader.
Yeah, I think, again, I mean, and that will be a splendid and wonderful, fun
storyline.
Turn the election into something interesting, precisely. But I mean, I suspect that actually we will just get, in a way, someone who was Zhuganov 20 years ago.
Zhuganov 20 years ago is kind of like Zhuganov now, if I remember correctly.
Presumably more mobile.
Yeah, he was a little more mobile, but he was not terribly exciting. Mark Bennett, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Communist Party, a reformed Communist Party, which, didn't frighten lots of people away with images of Stalin and just other nonsense, has massive potential in Russia. I mean, perhaps even with the images of Stalin, I don't know. I mean, traveling around Russia, I've met lots of Communist Party activists who kind of are very disappointed in Zhuganov and are just waiting for, as you said, a young, vibrant, dynamic leader. So I think the potential for a leftist party, whether it be called the Communist Party or not, is massive in Russia. If you even look at opinion polls, I mean, most Russians still think that a planned economy is the best economic model for the country. Nostalgia for the Soviet Union is widespread. Just the kind of leftist ideas of a social safety network for people. Yeah, so I think, then again, it all depends, like you said. I mean, will the Kremlin allow the Communist Party to turn into this kind of real opposition leftist party? At the moment, it's doubtful.
I mean, if we rewind in this podcast to 5 years ago, I remember the conversations where we thought Udaltsov had a lot of potential to play that role. And I guess that's probably explains why he is not a free man as we sit here.
He gets out in August.
He gets out in August? Well, God, just in time, right? Well, on that note, I guess we can wrap it up. Any last thoughts before we close it out? All right. Well, on that note, we will wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us on the Skype line from Moscow has been journalist Mark Bennett, author of the book I'm Going to Ruin Their Lives, Inside Putin's War on Russia's Opposition. Thank you, Mark and Mark, for an enlightening discussion.
pleasure.
I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Kancheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFERL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at RFERL.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noize MC.